start with a comment about a question from last time? And somebody asked, well, somebody said that they felt uncomfortable thinking of taking the derivative with z and z bar to be independent. And so I looked up a math book, and the book I looked up is one by Yano called Differential Geometry on Complex and Almost Complex Spaces. And according to Yano, the way to think about it is, yeah, almost complex spaces are, every even dimensional space is actually an almost complex space. In the first tutorial, we learned about a complex manifold as being, you know, an even dimensional space, which when you complexify, that is when you pair up the coordinates into complex coordinates, and then you cover, you can cover the space by coordinate charts. And the requirement is that in every overlap of the coordinate chart, the complex coordinate which covers that coordinate chart, the transformation has to be holomorphic. So for every, you know, overlap, the transformation of the coordinate has to be of this form. And that's a very restrictive requirement. It turns out that you can't do that for every even dimensional manifold. So when you can't do that, they're called almost complex spaces. Anyways, coming back, if you have some function x and y, you can, you know, write it as a function of z and z bar, and then kind of replace wherever the z bar is by some other quantity z star, and think of this function as living in some open set of a complex of two complex manifolds, where z is the coordinate in this one and z star is the coordinate in this one. And then you do the differentiation or whatever you want to do, and then at the end of the calculation, you set z star to z. Okay.
Just start to z bar, or?
Oh yeah, you're set. Yeah, sorry. Okay. So. So last time, we defined what a contour integral was.
Can I?
Yeah?
Wouldn't you always just be able to do that? And then, because you said that the homomorphic thing is that you don't have a z bar component.
Can you be a bit louder?
You said that for the homomorphic function, we don't have the z bar component.
Right. This is for any function,
yeah,
not necessarily homomorphic.
Yeah, you can always do. So.
Yes. So for a holomorphic function, I'm just talking about in general complex functions. Yeah, for the holomorphic functions, you know, it'll only, you know, there'll be a restriction on that, right? Which is that it'll be only a function of z, not z bars. So if you, for the holomorphic function, this is actually not even relevant.
Yeah,
right?
This was the initial problem, so that we have only a function of z, but that every time we vary z, we also vary z bar because.
Right, you can think of it as a combination of a particular combination, a particular linear combination of x and y. Z bar is not the same linear combination of x and y, it's a different linear combination of x and y.
Yeah.
So a holomorphic function cannot be expressed as a function of z bar. It is a particular, it depends on a particular linear combination of x and y. Yeah.
How does it work then? Because like the question arose from like taking the partial derivative of f to z, right? Holding z bar constant.
of f with respect to z bar so that it's zero, which meaning that there is no z bar component in your project.
No. The question, the
right.
question Alan asked with like the I don't see how you can vary z and not vary z bar.
Right.
The reason why we're writing it like that, but then you're still taking like the partial derivative to a complex number.
Yeah, it's a different complex number.
It's still.
It's a different.
It's
a different complex number. You're basically replacing your function by another function, wherever z bar was, you replace it by a new variable z star, and then so it's a function of two variables.
And then you evaluate.
And then at the end of your, you basically set z star equals to z bar.
Yes, but the variables are complex.
Yes, but they're different complex variables.
But if you take the partial derivative of f to z, what you want it to be is like a differentiating to a one-dimensional, a real one-dimensional thing, no?
So, okay, I'm not exactly following what you're trying to get at. Let's talk about it outside class because, you know, we just don't want to eat up more time, okay? Let's come back to that after class. Okay. So we defined the contour integral of a function over a simple curve or a Jordan curve to be this. Sorry. Where we evaluate the function on the curve and t is our parameter and the way we defined it ensured that this object is independent of the way that we parameterize the curve. And then we did a very simple example where we took a circle, and this is the symbol for a line integral over a closed curve, and it usually means you're doing the integral in the counterclockwise sense. This turned out to be 2 pi I if n is minus 1, 0 otherwise. So to get an insight into, additional insight into why this is so, let us apply the fundamental theorem of calculus to complex, to holomorphic functions. So as you know, the fundamental theorem of calculus relates differential calculus with integral calculus. So for holomorphic functions, so let U be an open subset of C. And now, you know, let gamma be a simple curve in C, and let F be a function from a holomorphic function, and let F be continuous. It's holomorphic and it's continuous in U. Now suppose, you know, there exists another function F, also defined in the same domain, such that the derivative of that function gives us small f. In other words, we can call f, big F, to be the antiderivative of small f. Then the fundamental theorem of calculus tells us that the line integral of our function small f of z is given by the big function f evaluated at the end of our contour. Now, if f is continuous, if gamma is a closed loop, and f is continuous, then we get zero, right? So that means that for this case, because gamma is a closed loop, the big F cannot be continuous. And of course, we know that because the integral over 1 over z is log of z, and log of z is a multivalued function. Okay, so. So the central jewel of complex analysis is the Cauchy theorem. Although that's not the theorem that's most often used. So next on our list is Cauchy's theorem. And I'll prove a version of it, which is shorter. Therefore, I'll make an additional assumption. And what I'll do is that I'll use Green's theorem, which is, Stokes' theorem in 2D. Okay, so what is Green's theorem? So let A be a two-dimensional vector field. With continuous first derivative. So in some simply connected region D. Now, if you don't know what simply connected region is, it means that any closed loop within that region can be shrunk to a point continuously without leaving that region. So, for example, this is the area within the square is a simply connected region. The area that lies between the square and the circle is not a simply connected region. Because in this guy, there are curves such as this, closed loops that cannot be shrunk to a point without leaving that region. So here we are interested in simply connected region. They can have all kinds of arbitrary shapes. Okay. So if that is the case, then the line integral over a closed loop of the vector field is given by the surface integral of the curl of that vector field in that same region. So here, what I mean by gamma is that gamma is the boundary of D. Okay. So this is a symbol used for boundary. By the way, if you ever go to Simon Center in Stony Brook, they have a wall of famous formulae. And in that formulae is this formula. The boundary of a boundary is zero. Doesn't exist or null. Anyway, that's aside. So this is Green's theorem. Now let us apply it to our holomorphic function. So we are assuming that f prime of z exists. Now, there's another version of Cauchy's theorem called, I think, Cauchy-Gorsaf theorem. And in that theorem, you don't have to make this assumption, but it's much longer. In fact, the fact that, the fact that this guy exists is actually a consequence of that theorem. So if you go down that route. Okay, so if you do this, then what we now do is that we just apply Green's theorem on the real and imaginary part of this. So you now break up f into u's and v. You break up z into x and y. And then you apply Green's theorem to, let's just write it out. Yeah, so you can then rewrite this as now this guy is nothing but twice d by dz bar. And since this guy is nothing but our holomorphic function, so this acting on f of z is going to give you 0. And this is Cauchy's theorem. So let me write that out. So let u be a simply connected region in C, and then let gamma be a closed loop in U, then if f of z is a holomorphic function in U or on U, I don't know which one it is, and f prime of z exists, then you get 0. So some consequences. First one is that suppose you have a curve joining point A and B, and you do a line integral on that. So this is curve number one, curve number two, and the region between that is bounded by curve number one and curve number two. That region, that f of z is holomorphic there. And f of z has no, that is, it has, doesn't have any singularity, or it's very nice. If that is the case, then this theorem tells us that So, okay, let's just say the integral of that function along the curve one is equal to the integral over integral of the function along curve two, right? Sorry, let's. But of course, you have to make sure that there are no singularities, that the and the function is holomorphic in the region. So you can continuously open a deform a contour into another contour as long as you don't run into a singularity of the function and the function is holomorphic in that region. Okay. So a useful variation of the Cauchy's theorem is a result on multiply connected region. And suppose that we have a function that is So suppose we have a function that is we don't go into singularities now. Great, okay. So suppose we have a multiply connected region. So we have some closed curve C1, and we have some other curves C2, C3, and C4. And our function is holomorphic in this region. That is bounded between C1 and these curves. Now, we can now do a bit of surgery, and what we can do is that we can, like, build some small bridges like this. We can do this sort of surgery and get a different curve. And now I'm just going to put a counterclockwise. I'm going to show that this is actually now a simply connected region. So as I go around this way and I go along here like that inside, and then I go around the eye like that and I come out, and then I go around and I go around this mouth. So, right? So I've shown that after surgery, this region, the region that I initially drew minus these areas, you know, there is that it's a simply connected region. Therefore, in this new, sorry,
how did that show that?
Okay, let me just make a smaller, like a simpler example, where you know this is not simply connected, right?
No.
So what I've done is that if I draw a bridge, then this becomes simply connected, because then, you know, you cannot, any curve within that region can be shrunk to zero.
Sure, okay.
Right? So we have done that, but I've kind of added on to.
You basically prevented it from going around that.
Right, exactly. I've created an obstruction for the loop to be created, right? So let's call this new curve gamma, and now we can apply Cauchy's theorem to this new curve. And this is so. Now, because the function is holomorphic and it has very nice differentiable properties, we can bring these bridges, these two bridges, as close to each other as we like. And because the integral is done in the opposite sense on each of these, on this bridge as opposed to, as compared to this bridge, the contribution from the bridge above will exactly cancel the contribution from the bridge below in the limit where we take these two bridges to coincide. Similarly here. So now, if I now write out this integral, then you know it'll have a contribution from C1. So let me just symbolically write that as C1. And it'll have a contribution from C2, but going in the opposite direction. So there'll be minus of C2. Similarly for C3 and C4. And then there will be these remainders, which come from these bridges. But those guys will go to zero in the limit where I bring the bridges close to each other. So they will drop out in that limit, and they will give me zero. So in other words, I will get the result that the integral over C1, so now let me rewrite this again. This is C1. And I think, yeah, C1, and then this is C2, C3, C4, where all the integrals are taken in the counterclockwise sense, then right? Okay, so that shows, that is the extension. So what does this mean? That means that we can always, if you have a contour integral over a closed curve, we can always break that up into smaller integrals as long as the region that is bounded between the big curve and the smaller curves is a region where the function is holomorphic. And this is an extremely useful result. Okay, now I'm going to just quote some formulae. And one of the formulae is that if a function is holomorphic in some region C, so we have some regions, we have some curve C, and it's holomorphic inside, and suppose there's a point inside A, then the value of the function at that point is given by the contour integral over of the function over the contour divided by z minus a. I'm not going to prove this, but in other words, given a holomorphic function, you know, we can always find a the value of the function in any point within a region just by evaluating the function on the boundary. So if you know the value of a function on the boundary of a region and we know that it's holomorphic inside, the function is completely determined. Right? So you can think of it as, you know, there's an analogous, actually the same result in electrostatics, where you know that any solution of Laplace's equation, you know, it's uniquely determined inside a region if you give its boundary conditions, right? And this is the two-dimensional version of it. Of course, this should not be surprising because, you know, f of a, the holomorphic function is secretly, not secretly, actually very explicitly almost, a solution of Laplace's equation in 2D, right? Okay. I don't think that blackboard has been fixed yet. Let's see. But we can use it. Oh, I think it has been fixed, yes. Right. So we can, given the, so this formula is called Cauchy's integral formula. And let me write this again. Now we can differentiate the Cauchy's integral formula n times under the integral sign. So I'm, I'm differentiating it under the integral sign. So, I switched from A to Z here. And let's call this thing the nth, denoted by this, and this you can very easily show it's given by and these FNs are nothing but the coefficients of the Taylor series expansion of that function at that point. So if I do a Taylor expansion around the point A, then these Fn's are given by this guy. Okay. So the Taylor series goes from 0 to infinity. There is another series in complex analysis which is very useful. And it's a series that we can apply to a holomorphic function where the function is not holomorphic at all points, where it actually has singularities at isolated points. And that series is called the Lohan series. So let me just first assume that suppose our function f of z is holomorphic in some annular region, meaning that the region is contained within two concentric circles. Okay, so this region is called, this is called an annulus. Then so given now, so let's this be the z naught, and let z be some point within this annulus. Then there exists a series expansion of this function in this annular region, which is of this form. Right now, in principle, the number of terms, the sum goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. And there are some coefficients. And these coefficients are given by a formula that looks like the Cauchy's integral formula. So if you have some C Now, if in case that the function fz doesn't have a, it's actually is holomorphic in the whole region. So not just the annulus, but the disk contained within this outer circle, then this will become the, you know, Taylor expansion. Sorry? Okay. Now, this is called the Laurent series. And given the point Z naught, the coefficient of the Laurent series are unique. Okay, so the point that you choose to expand around, once you've decided on that, the expansion of the series in the in a region annular, in an annular region is unique. So let's look at some Laurent series. And it'll become very obvious why it's an interesting and important thing to do. So let's take a function that is holomorphic on an annular region, and we can think of, say, one over sine of z. So this function is blows up at the origin. And okay, so there's a, I just realized there's a typo here. And I said that that this is actually, I say in my notes, find the Laurent series expansion for f of z in the annular region, which includes all of the complex plane except the origin. That's not true, right? Because wherever the sine of z has a zero, this guy has, you know, has a singularity. And sine of z has zeros all along the real axis, right? So the annular region that we are, that I'm going to just expand it is the region that is contained with between the origin and pi. Okay, so there is a singularity of this function at zero, and then there's another one at pi, right? So this is the region that we are going to be expanding. So expand it around the origin. And what you do is that you basically, you know, do the a Taylor series expansion of sine, and then do a binomial expansion. And this is what you get. In case you're going to do this example yourself, just note that to get this term, you have to do the binomial expansion up to second order. Otherwise, so the binomial expansion from the first order and the second order, they, from this guy and this guy, they actually add up to give you this term. So why are Laurent series useful? That's because it allows us to do a lot of line integrals, a lot of contour integrals by cheating. Okay. And that statement is given in Cauchy's residue theorem. So before I prove the residue theorem, let's come back to our favorite result, So this implies that when we are doing an integral around the Laurent series expansion of a function such as this, the term that is going to contribute to this integral is the term which contains z to the power minus 1. So all the other terms are going to drop out. And it's going to give us the coefficient of 1 over z times 2 pi I, right? And so this coefficient is so important, it actually has a name. It's called the residue. So the a minus 1 in the Laurent series expansion, it's called the residue of the function at the point around which we are expanding the function in a Laurent series. Okay. So let me prove the theorem now. Well, I'll just write it down and it'll prove itself. So we have some region, say, some contour C. And suppose the function has some singularities where it's not holomorphic. You know, within that region. Suppose there are small circles or curves like so. So this is an alien head. It has more than two eyes.
Or a dead guy.
Sorry?
Or a dead guy.
Or dead guy.
Yeah.
Do dead guys have more than two eyes?
No,
he's been shot. Clever.
Making a surprise face.
Oh, yes, okay. Right, so by our result for a multiply connected region, we know that we can now write the contour integral over C in terms of contour integral over C1. And then what we do is that we expand each of this function around the point z1, z2, z3, z, you know, dot, dot, zk in Laurent series. So inside each of this integral, we have so. Where by a1n, I mean the coefficient of the first series, the nth coefficient of the first series. And similarly, ank. And so now we can just use our favorite result of integration, and then hence we see that this is equal to 2 pi I summed over p goes from 1 to k a p of minus 1. So this is the Cauchy's This is Cauchy's residue theorem. In other words, the line integral of a function on a closed contour is given by the sum of the residues of the function at the singular points which are contained inside that region times 2 pi I. So singularities become very important, right? So let's classify these singularities. Poles. So I'm not going to tell you about my Polish joke here, because we are not allowed to do those things. But if you want to hear it, look up last year's lecture. It's not a bad joke.
Were you seriously reprimanded for that?
Sorry?
Were you reprimanded for it?
No, I wasn't. But, it is slightly racially tinged. So
The guy who made the joke first was Polish.
Was he?
Yes.
Oh, then I can say it, right?
Polish?
Okay, this is becoming too important. Let's move on. It ends with a frustrated Polish guy on a plane. He's supposed to bring to safety a modern 747, and he him saying I'm just a simple Pole on a complex plane, right? So, it doesn't work when I give you just a punchline. So. Anyway, so although the Laurent series in principle has an infinite number of terms for goes from minus infinity to plus infinity, all these terms need not be there. It just has to have at least one term with negative power of z. So if your series expansion is of this form, so you have and then the positive powers. In other words, if the negative part of the series terminates at a finite number of terms, then the point z naught where the function fz blows up, that point is called a pole. So z naught is a pole. Now you can see that if I multiply this function by say z by z naught to the power n, then this new function, g of z, no longer has that pole. So if the value of this integer n is 1, then we call it a simple pole. Otherwise, it's a higher order pole. The second type of singularity is called an essential singularity. And these are singularities which arise when the Lohan-series expansion has an infinite number of negative powered power of 1 over z, or 1 over z minus z naught. So an example is this guy. So there is no function you like. So you cannot take a. You cannot multiply it by a factor like this and get rid of the singularity here. Okay. In other words, the number of powers with negative powers of z is infinite here. And so this guy has an essential singularity at z equals to 0. Just another terminology. If a function has poles only on the finite part of the complex plane, it's called a meromorphic function. You don't really need it, but I'll just sometimes you'll come across terminology. So this guy, for example, has poles only on the finite part of the complex plane. Okay. So now let me give you a strategy for computing the residue of a function where the pole is not a simple pole, where it's a higher order pole. So for such cases, the function will have some expansion like this. And there's a formula for finding out a minus 1. And what you do is that you multiply the function by the highest, by the order, by this factor raised to the power, which is the order of the pole. So this is no longer a singular function. And you take its derivative, n minus 1 term. So you get rid of all these terms. You kill off these terms. And then there's a combinatorial factor. And then after doing this, you take the limit where z goes to z naught. So this is the formula for computing the residue for a higher order pole. So in the remaining 20 minutes, this won't take me 20 minutes, which is good. Let me just do some calculations. Some examples of calculations of poles. And these, you have to know the principle, but these days you can just plug the function into Mathematica and say, compute the residue of the function at this point, and it'll do it for you. But still, you have to be clever sometimes. So let's take some rational function. So a rational function is a function which has this form. It is the ratio of two polynomials. So P and Q are polynomials. So let's assume that Q has simple zeros. Q has simple zeros. And let's assume that Kim, okay, has a simple zero at z equals to z naught. If that is the case, then f of z has a simple pole at z equals to z naught. So, in other words, Q of z naught is zero, but since it's simple, meaning that if you take the derivative of Q naught at z naught, it is not zero. Right? So then you can just do a Taylor expansion of Q. Around this zero point, so this is zero. And then this shows that if you take the residue of this function at z naught is given by right. So this factor is canceling this factor, right? And this is what you have left. So this is the residue. Okay, so let's see. Let's do it. You know, so this is kind of a very simple example. Let's do some explicit examples. I'll just do two. And in tomorrow's tutorial, we'll do a bunch of examples that you'll need to use. That you'll use then to compute some contour integrals. So tomorrow's tutorial will be a little, there'll be parallel tracks. So there will be some of these calculations, but there will be also a problem on conformal field theory. So depending on what you want to do. So now, I wanted to put that problem on conformal field theory because I just wanted to show that very basic complex analysis actually can maybe become very useful in doing in a quantum field theory. So let's take a function. And oh, by the way, today's tutorial will be all about conformal transformations. So don't miss it. So let's take this function. So this has poles at plus IA and minus IA. And then we can just use that formula. So suppose we want to find the pole, you know, the pole at IA. And what we do is that we just use that formula and then, you know, what we find is the residue of f of z at IA is two IA. And the residue, so let's just put plus here and minus here. And that's actually plus minus. Okay. So this is a trivial example. My last, so I have three examples here, exercises, and they're pretty straightforward. But the last one is interesting, and let me do that in class right now. Because the last one actually uses the periodicity property of the function. So find the residues of the following function at its singularities. So the function I'm going to take is e to the power z divided by sine squared of z. So this has an infinite number of poles, right? And the poles are along the real axis, wherever the denominator goes to zero. So the poles are at n pi. So let me first find out the pole at the origin, the residue of the pole at the origin. And in these kind of problems, often, there are no general formula for deriving the residue. You actually have to just do a Taylor expansion. You actually have to do a Lohan expansion, which sometimes means that you have to do the Taylor expansion of the component parts of the function. And that what we'll do right now is, so I take this guy and the numerator, I expand it like this. The denominator, I expand. Hang on. I may have made a mistake here. Yeah, I think I let's do this example. I think that's what I did. Okay, because you know it's got the same kind of properties as far as it doesn't change the values of the zeros. So now I can just pull out 1 over z, and you know the series in the numerator remains the same, and the denominator now I can write it as 1 minus z squared divided by factorial 3, and I'm just going to keep the leading term. So I've got a minus 1 here. So I've got this guy. I just have to keep enough terms so that I find the residue, the term that contains the residue. So right. So we get 1 plus z squared by factorial of 3 if I multiply this and this. And then when I multiply this and this, I get a z. then z cubed, and I get higher order term. So I see that when I multiply by 1 over z, you know, all these terms, you know, they still have either positive powers of z or it's a constant. So it's really the first term which gives me the residue, and the coefficient of 1 over z, there is 1. So the residue at the origin is, so at z equals to 0, we find that the residue at the origin is this thing, and don't forget this guy, e to the power 0 is 1, so it's 1, right? So now, using this, now we can find the residues at all the other points. And to find all the other points, all you need to do is to say, OK, just observe that if I am considering finding the residue around the point n of pi, what I want to do is that I want to expand this function around that n of pi. So here, z is a new variable, which allows me to expand around n of pi. So here I have, I replace z by z plus n of pi. But this guy is periodic, so so essentially we can now see that the computation of the residue of the function at z equals to n of pi boils down to the same computation that we did earlier. But now, whatever residue we find, we have to multiply it by e of n of pi. So this shows us that the residue at z equals to n pi is e to the power n of pi. So I don't think having a square would have changed it, but that's not, you know, I didn't work that out, so I don't want to make any mistakes. So that's all I have. Any questions? Yeah?
Why did you just go from sine of z plus n pi to sine of z? Like if n is odd, it's not.
There's a factor of minus 1 to
minus 1. Oh, yeah. So,
like minus 1.
Yeah, there is a, you're right. Yeah.
N, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, you're right. Yeah. Yes. And I think that's the difference. If I had put a square here, then that sign would have disappeared. Yes, you're right. Yeah. All right. Anything else? Yeah?
Couldn't you just apply the formula for the polynomial? I think it also works. I mean, the sine functions have some roots, right? But they are simple roots. They are
right.
So
yeah. So
somehow you can think of that as a polynomial.
Exactly.
Root.
Locally, you can think of it.
Yeah. So you can.
So you can actually use that formula.
Yeah.
You're right. Work. Yeah. But you can't always. Like for some of the other series, you can't. Right. So you have to, if you want to use that, you know, the rational function polynomial, you have to make sure that whatever function you have in the denominator, at least locally, it looks like, you know, it has only positive finite number of negative powers or something.
So it has a simple root.
Yeah.
That you can write it as c minus 6,0 for that times some holomorphic function.
Exactly. And in fact, that's something, I think, an example we do tomorrow will actually use that fact. So. All right? Awesome. Yeah, any other questions? All right.